Turntor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Malice, Remorse and a Rocking Horse by Sherry Bryan. Narrated by Esther Wayne. Chapter 1. Jerry Braithwaite walked back to his cell with a cocky swagger. His fellow inmates whooped and called out his name, and he acknowledged their enthusiasm with an exaggerated grin.
Better luck next time, eh? Said the guard when they reached his cell.
As the door shut behind him, Jerry's jaw, aching from the fake smile to disguise his disappointment, sagged as he slumped onto the bed and put his head in his hands.
Sorry it didn't go the way you'd hoped.
The guard threw a sympathetic nod in Jerry's direction before locking the cell door and leaving him alone with his thoughts. Since the day of his arrest, he'd protested his innocence, but nobody had wanted to listen. He'd decided early on that the best way to deal with his jail term without going mad was to keep his head down, keep out of trouble, and keep busy. His behaviour couldn't have been better. He flung himself back on his bed and fixed his eyes on the bottom of the top bunk. It had been a long day, but as tired as he was, he knew sleep would be a long time coming tonight. What had gone wrong? He was the model prisoner. Even the prison guards couldn't believe he wasn't a free man by now. Everyone had expected his request for parole to be approved, for his right to freedom to be granted. But that day wasn't today. Outside the prison gates, a mass of Jerry's fans grew increasingly restless. A skinny peroxide blonde in a leather jumpsuit and wearing a ring through her nose held up her hand to the crowd.
Shh! There's some news about Jerry's parole hearing.
The crowd fell silent as she held her phone to her ear.
Our news just breaking,
she called out, repeating the newscaster's report.
In the last few minutes, Jerry Braithwaite, lead singer of the band Rocking Horse, has been denied early release by a parole board for the third time during his 20-year sentence.
The crowd hissed and booed, and the leather-suited fan hushed them again, pressing her phone closer to her ear.
Bliss Bay-born Mr. Braithwaite, who also has a home in Exeter, was jailed 15 years ago after being convicted of the murder of Zara Brett. We'll bring you more news as we have it.
She shoved her phone back into her pocket and addressed the crowd.
We have to let him know we'll never forget him, and we'll be waiting for him when he finally gets out.
Looking up at the dreary sky, she began to sing Jerry's most well-known song, Little Dove.
Through the darkness, you brought me light.
The crowd picked up the chorus, swaying along with the words.
You never failed me. You brought me peace, hope, and love. Little Dove, Little Dove.
As the song came to an end, and the crowd roared Jerry's name over and over, a fan watching from a distance pulled up the hood of a dark jacket and left. In the cafe across the street, around a table of coffees and teas gone cold, the conversation was all about Jerry Braithwaite.
"Oh, sure he'd get parole this time, won't you?" "I can't believe they didn't let him out. He served enough time."
"Don't be ridiculous. He killed that woman. He'll never serve enough time, in my opinion. He should have been given life."
"But he didn't do it intentionally. It was an accident. He's innocent."
"You would say that, wouldn't you? You're a die-hard fan."
"They probably didn't release him because they think he's still a danger to society."
"Don't talk such rubbish. He never was a danger to society. If he says he didn't kill that woman, then he didn't kill her."
"Well, he's bound to say that he didn't do it, isn't he?"
The lively discussions went on, back and forth, until, conversation exhausted, everyone left for home. Everyone except the solitary, hooded stranger sitting at a small table in the corner, engrossed in the first edition of the evening newspaper left by a previous customer. Stop press. Rock singer denied parole for a third time. Jerry Braithwaite was arrested 15 years ago, after the body of 30-year-old Zara Brett was found in his bathroom at the Princess Hotel in Exeter, following an after-concert party to which a number of fans had been invited. A post-mortem established the cause of Miss Brett's death to be strangulation, refuting Braithwaite's insistence that the woman must have fallen asleep in the bath and drowned. He has always denied any involvement in her death, but, as there was no one else in the room apart from him and Miss Brett, he was arrested on suspicion of her murder the following morning. At the time, reaction to his 20-year sentence was mixed. Some thought it was too lenient, but many others considered it too harsh for the crime, a popular theory being that the judge was making an example of the flamboyant singer. Though Braithwaite maintained his innocence and his legions of loyal fans protested at his arrest, it took a jury less than 3 hours to return a guilty verdict. Following the unsuccessful hearing, Mr. Braithwaite has a maximum of 5 more years to serve behind bars. Whether he applies for parole again remains to be seen. The stranger read the article twice before paying the bill and leaving the cafe. Once home, behind a desk in a concealed room, a single unshaded light bulb hung from the beams in the ceiling, swinging gently from its cable and casting shadows across the walls. Reaching out a shaky hand for the framed picture of Jerry that sat on the edge of the desk, the stranger held it close and said,
"You should have got parole. You should have got it. You've more than paid for what happened. I thought I'd done enough to avenge you, but I was wrong. I'm sorry I let you down, but it won't happen again. I promise."
Christopher Duncan straightened up from digging the flower beds in his back garden and wiped the perspiration from his forehead with a muddy gardening glove.
"Want a cup of tea?"
his wife Stella called from the kitchen window.
"Of course I want a cup of tea," he snapped, from behind the crimson flowers of the vast rhododendron on the edge of the lawn.
He leaned on a garden fork and surveyed his morning's work. The previous residents of the cottage, an elderly couple who hadn't touched the garden in years, had left plenty for him to do. He'd tidied the beds and borders, but was putting off tackling the bindweed-infested lawn until Stella could help. It was a 2-person job, but it could wait until she'd finished preparing the inside walls of the house for decorating, a job he was thankful not to be doing. He turned up the volume on the radio and chuckled to himself, wondering how long Stella would wait until suggesting he turn it down. Stella was keen to make a good impression in Crocus Dell, the quiet village to which she and Christopher had recently moved. That meant, according to her self-imposed rules, no loud music, no talking too loudly outdoors, and absolutely no power or garden tools until she'd forewarned the neighbours of the noise as a courtesy. As far as Stella was concerned, it just wouldn't do to fall out with the neighbours before they'd even met most of them. The exception was the couple next door. Helena and Lucas Perry had brought round a fruitcake and a flask of tea when they'd seen the removal van, with a promise to call round again in a few days with a bottle of bubbly to properly welcome them to the neighbourhood. Christopher had scowled at the gift. He didn't see the need for people to live in each other's pockets just because they happened to be neighbours, and had been on the verge of telling Helena and Lucas just that when Stella had given him one of her looks. He usually ignored them, but decided, on that occasion, perhaps it was better to say nothing. He let out a sigh of contentment as he closed his eyes and lifted his face to the sun's warmth. The move had been a long time coming, and it felt good to relax at last. He looked forward to his retirement. He planned to golf and fish as often as possible. Only the previous week, when he joined the local golf club, he got chatting with some of the other members who'd invited him to join them on a group trip to Ireland.
"Excellent for golf and fishing," they'd said.
Not that Stella enjoyed golf or fishing, but that wasn't his problem. She'd have to find some other way to occupy her time. There was only one thing keeping him from complete happiness. Jerry Braithwaite. The man had followed him around for years, like chewing gum stuck to his shoe. If someone wasn't talking about him on TV, they were writing about him in the newspapers. It had been bad enough being jury foreman at his murder trial 15 years ago. He tried hard to forget the stress it had caused, but each time a parole hearing came up and he saw Jerry's face plastered all over the news, it brought back terrible memories of the trial and its aftermath. After the verdict, Christopher had thought that would be the end of it. Case closed. He'd begun to get on with his life, but just when everything had finally got back to normal, anonymous hate mail had started dropping through his letterbox. Cards bearing menacing pictures of funeral wreaths started arriving with alarming regularity at his home, the sender venting their displeasure at the way the trial had ended. It was you who delivered the guilty verdict. You as good as put Jerry behind bars yourself. You deserve to be punished.
Individually cut letters from newspapers and magazines had been stuck onto the cards to form every word, each one bearing the message, "For Jerry." The fact that someone had found out his name and address made Christopher feel nauseous. The court had never referred to any of the jury members by their names, only by numbers. 10 cards had arrived over the space of the next 10 weeks. They all bore the same message, but each one had felt a little more intimidating than the last. He reported them to the police and handed them over as evidence, but, in his opinion, the police hadn't treated the matter seriously enough. They'd given him a lame reassurance that if they got any leads, they'd investigate and let him know. He'd hoped they'd give him some protection, or even station a car outside the house, but they hadn't. They said whoever had sent the letters was simply trying to make him uneasy, and offered to send a patrol car to drive past the house a couple of times after dark, but nothing else. As Christopher had explained to the police many times, as jury foreman, he was just doing a job. It was nothing personal. It wasn't his fault Jerry Braithwaite had been sentenced to a lengthy prison term. However, he'd never told them he'd had no trouble in finding Jerry guilty. He hadn't even needed to deliberate with the other jurors to be sure of his guilt. As soon as he'd laid eyes on Jerry, he'd made up his mind that the scruffy rock singer had killed that poor girl. Disgusting reprobate. Christopher had done all he could to make sure the maximum sentence was handed down. When the hate mail stopped as suddenly as it had started, Christopher and Stella had managed to put the stress behind them and get on with their lives. Now they had their dream cottage in a quiet village, with primrose-coloured wooden shutters on the windows, a country garden, mature fruit trees, and the vegetable patch he'd always wanted. He shuddered and put all thoughts of Jerry Braithwaite from his mind. All that was 15 years behind him. He had only to look forward now. Stella walked towards him with a mug of tea in each hand. "Here we are."
"About time."
Christopher took his tea from her and cupped his gloved hands around the mug.
"Don't you think you should turn down the volume on the radio?"
said Stella, a frown line running all the way down her forehead to her nose.
"Why?"
Christopher hid his inner smile and blew on his tea.
"You know very well why,"
said Stella, turning the volume knob to the left before stretching out on the lawn.
"That's better, and thank goodness those workmen have stopped their infernal drilling and gone for a break. The constant sound of that hammer drill pounding on the pavement outside the house is enough to drive you mad. I shall be glad when they pack up their things and leave."
Christopher ignored her and nodded to the rhododendron.
"We'll have to add moving that to our to-do list. I've no idea how we're going to do it, though. It's so huge the roots must go on for miles."
"Well, don't look at me," said Stella, swatting away a wasp with her hand. "You know I've never been blessed with green fingers. Didn't Lucas say he'd be happy to give us a hand if we needed any help with the garden?"
"You mean that idiot from next door?"
Christopher shook his head.
"You know how I feel about people we barely know nosing around in our business."
"For heaven's sake, we'd only be asking him for a little help moving a bush," said Stella tightly,
a nervous tick causing her nose to twitch.
"It's not as though we're going to give him our bank statements to look through."
Christopher glared at her.
"Well, you ask him then," he huffed, "and don't get too friendly. I don't want him thinking he can pop round here every 5 minutes. You know what some people are like. You give them an inch and they practically move in."
"I'll do that then."
Stella's shoulders dropped visibly as she relaxed.
"We'll only need him to help with a few bits out here. I don't think we'll have to do much with the front garden at all, do you? I love the magnolia tree, and the honeysuckle has such a glorious scent. It'd be a crime to cut it down. I'm quite happy for both of them to stay where they are."
She cocked her head.
"Was that the doorbell?"
She started to push herself up to her feet.
"I'll go."
Christopher put down his mug and took off his gardening gloves.
"In any case, I want to check what you've done inside so I know how long I'll need to set aside to redo it properly."
Stella bit back a retort, lay on the grass and closed her eyes. Several minutes later, according to her watch, she woke up. Looking around, she saw that Christopher's mug of tea was still on the edge of the raised flowerbed.
It must have been the neighbours at the door. They're probably chatting.
She got up and dusted herself off, hoping that Christopher hadn't been too offhand. He could be quite rude if he wasn't in the mood for socialising. She, on the other hand, was very much looking forward to making new friends. Picking up the mug of cold tea, she made her way back to the house.
"Who is it, Christopher?"
she called, putting the mugs in the sink. She frowned as she caught sight of her messy decorating clothes in the mirror and smoothed them down as best she could. She hated greeting guests when she wasn't looking her best. Pushing up the ends of her hair with her palms, she fixed a smile on her face and made her way through the kitchen and the dining room to the front door.
"Strange. I can't hear any voices. They must be in the front garden."
Stella stepped into the small hallway and stopped dead in her tracks. Christopher was lying in a heap on the doorstep. She let out a scream and rushed to him, her hands flying to her mouth when she saw the message written on one of his hands, which simply said, "For Jerry."
Chapter 2.
"Where are my damn keys?"
Jack Windsor raked his fingers through his dark hair and tossed cushions across the couch as he hunted for the bunch of keys, which had gone missing for the fourth time that week.
"Megan, take a look in Blue's bed, will you?"
He shook his head at the boxer dog who sat at attention, his eyes locked on him like a heat-seeking missile. Megan Fallon stuck a hand under the blanket in the dog bed and felt around.
"No, they're not there. And they're not under the couch, either."
Dropping to her knees, she scratched the dog behind the ears.
"Blue," she said in a stern voice, "where have you hidden them this time?"
The dog turned his head and gave her a guilty look, then fixed his gaze back on Jack.
"Found them."
Jack triumphantly pulled the keys from down the side of the armchair. He tapped Blue gently on the nose.
"You gotta stop doing that, buddy."
"Can't you train him not to?" said Megan.
"I've tried," said Jack. "I've taught him a ton of stuff since I adopted him, but I just can't teach him to leave the keys alone. He's got a thing about them. I always mean to put them out of his reach, but if I forget, you can bet they'll disappear."
He glanced at his watch.
"Okay, we'd better make tracks."
He picked up a holdall and a bag of Blue's food and made his way outside.
"Now, are you sure you're going to be okay on your own?"
A frown crumpled his brow as he settled his dog into the back of the car.
"Perfectly sure."
Megan restrained an eye roll and made a fuss of the boxer. "How many more times are you going to ask?"
"Well, you haven't been on your own since you moved in, have you? I've always been here. And Blue, too."
"You remember that party I had a couple of months ago?" said Megan. "The one with the balloons and the big cake with all the candles on it? That was for my 40th. I'm 40 years old, Jack. I think I can take care of myself. And I didn't move in so you could babysit me. If you recall, one of the main criteria of me coming to live at Bayview was that it wouldn't interfere with your life, and likewise, you living a few feet away wouldn't interfere with mine."
She shooed him away with a grin.
"Go on. Go and see your friends and stop worrying about me. You're my landlord, not my bodyguard."
"And your friend. Friends worry about each other, you know."
"Yes, I know. But you're only going away for a long weekend, so you'll be back before you know it. What on earth do you think's going to happen between now and then? Anyway, Mum and Dad are only a few minutes away, so are Uncle Des and Auntie Sylve, and Petal's just down the road. I've got family and friends coming out of my ears. It's not as though I'm cut off from civilization in the wilderness, is it?"
Megan placed a hand on her hip and arched a brow.
I suppose not."
Jack pulled her into a hug, then stepped back and fixed her with a serious look.
"Don't forget to double lock the front door before you go to bed, will you?"
Megan nodded, and returned his look with an equally serious one.
"Okay, Dad, I won't,"
she said, mimicking his American accent.
"I'm not kidding," said Jack,
chuckling as he settled himself in the driver's seat.
"Me neither. I've got my big girl pants on, and I'm quite capable of looking after myself. If anything, I should be worrying about you. You know how clumsy you are. I've only just recovered from you falling headfirst into Olivia's homemade chutney display at the village shop."
"It was an accident," said Jack indignantly. "I paid for the damage, and I helped clean up. Anyways, it was a stupid idea to build a display of glass jars. If I hadn't knocked it over, someone else would have.
Olivia's been doing it every Christmas for years, and no one's ever sent it flying before, said Megan. She said she's still finding pieces of dried fruit where they shouldn't be. Anyway, my point is, you're a complete liability. I'll be okay while you're away, but who's going to look after you? Who's going to pick you up when you fall over or crash into something? Jack couldn't help but laugh.
I'm sure I'll be fine.
Promise you'll look after yourself? Said Megan.
Cross my heart, said Jack, mimicking her English accent.
She gave him a playful swipe and pushed the car door shut, leaning her elbows on the window frame. Well, as much as I'd love to, I haven't got time to stand here all day chatting to you. She began counting off her tasks on her fingers. I'm helping Mum and Auntie Sylve sort through the toy donations the Women's Association is collecting for local kids. Then I'm working on the charity dinner and auction this afternoon, and then I'm popping in to see Uncle Des because he's like a bear with a sore head since he had his knee operation. I'm going to be so busy, I probably won't even notice you're gone. She treated Jack to a broad grin.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
He returned the grin, and his dimples made an appearance as he turned the key in the ignition.
I'll be back sometime on Monday. Maybe I'll see you, if you're not too busy with your hectic social life, that is.
He held an arm out of the window, waving as he drove down the drive and out onto the road. Megan waved until he was out of sight and let out a long breath. As much as she loved having Jack around, and he was an amazing friend, she was quite looking forward to her own company for a change. Since moving into Bayview, the self-contained apartment in the grounds of Jack's new home, the beautifully renovated old schoolhouse, life had been pretty hectic. Bayview had proved to be the perfect place for her. She'd been staying at her childhood home, Kismet Cottage, since returning to Bliss Bay, but as much as she adored her mum and dad, moving back in with them on a permanent basis wasn't an appealing prospect. She'd been looking for somewhere else to live when Jack had offered her first refusal on the apartment. Having built it to take any overspill of family and friends who came to visit, he decided Megan could make better use of it instead. Overlooking the bay, the apartment had spectacular views and was close to everyone and everything important in her life. She hadn't had to think for too long before taking him up on his offer. It was peaceful, and the ideal working environment. Her small event and party planning business had been going better than she'd hoped, and she had Bayview to thank for providing such a peaceful and inspiring office. She pulled her long, dark hair into a ponytail and took a deep lungful of fresh air before stretching her fingers up to the sky and leaning forward to touch her toes. "I must give Evie a call over the next couple of days," she murmured. Her daughter's gap year in New Zealand was almost over. Just another couple of months and she'd be home. Megan did a few more stretches before going inside and pouring a cup of coffee. She picked up the newspaper lying on the arm of the couch and curled up to flick through it before getting ready for the day. Jerry Braithwaite's recent failure to get parole still monopolised the front page, as it had for the past week. She looked at the two pictures of him featured in the article. One taken 15 years ago on his way to court on the first day of his trial showed him smiling and waving at his fans as though he didn't have a care in the world. It contrasted sharply with the one taken recently, his long dark hair having acquired more than its fair share of grey, his pale, haggard face with bags under his eyes, and the permanent furrow between his brows, all telltale signs of the prison life he'd endured for the past 15 years. She stopped turning the pages when a headline caught her eye. Crocus Dell resident murdered in doorstep attack. Christopher Duncan, a 65-year-old retired company director from the village of Crocus Dell, was killed at his home in Hemsworth Drive on Tuesday morning. The exact cause of death has yet to be established, but the police are treating it as murder. According to the officer in charge of the investigation, Detective Inspector Sam Cambridge, the motive for Mr. Duncan's murder is being investigated, and no further details are available at this time. However, we have learned from an anonymous source that evidence left at the scene may connect the incident to rock singer Jerry Braithwaite, and that Mr. Duncan was the jury foreman at Braithwaite's trial 15 years ago. We have no more information on that claim at present, and must stress that at the time of going to print, this theory is based purely on speculation. Mr. and Mrs. Duncan had only recently moved from Oxeter to Croker's Dell to enjoy their retirement, and, according to members of the small community, hadn't even had a chance to meet most of their neighbours. Mr. Duncan's widow, Stella, is currently being comforted by family members. Megan re-read the article and looked at the photograph of the murder victim's home, cordoned off with police crime scene tape, and turned the page with a shiver. A spate of murders in Bliss Bay over the past year had put the whole village on high alert for a while, but peace had been restored in recent months. This alarming new report of an attack on a defenceless man made her stomach churn, resurrecting feelings she'd hoped were gone for good. Even the knowledge that the murder hadn't taken place in Bliss Bay itself did nothing to calm her anxiety. It was still too close for comfort. The only consolation she drew from the report was learning that Sam Cambridge was leading the investigation. During his time in the village the previous year, Megan had grown to think highly of the stalwart, no-nonsense detective. She gulped down her coffee and reached for her phone, which was vibrating on the couch cushion next to her. "Hi, Mum." "Oh, darling, thank goodness you're there. Are you watching From Breakfast to Brunch?" "No." "Well, switch it on. Hugh's going to be on after the break." "What?" "Hugh, your ex-fiancé. Switch it on. I'm on my way round." Megan opened the front door and switched on the TV, her stomach churning. Hugh didn't usually feature in her daily thoughts, but right now he was all she could think of. The commercial break came to an end, coinciding with the arrival of Claudia Fallon, screeching to a halt on the drive and sending a spray of gravel into the air. "Have I missed it?" she asked breathlessly as she rushed through the open door, pulling her dark curls off her lightly suntanned forehead with a wide, flowery hairband. "No, it's just started again." "He's written a book." Claudia wagged a finger at the screen. Megan's knees gave way, and she dropped onto the couch to see her ex-fiancé guesting on the popular morning TV show. He looked tanned and relaxed, and perfectly at home as he waited for the interview to begin. "So, welcome to the show, Hugh. Your autobiography, Finding Hugh, has become a runaway bestseller," simpered the leggy blonde presenter, eyeing him from beneath her trademark eyelash flutter. "Can you tell us a bit about how that happened?"
"Well, I'd always wanted to write my autobiography," said Hugh, looking directly at the camera. "Not for the public, you understand, just for me, and for any friends and family who might have been interested in reading it. I self-published it and had no intention of promoting it, but it was noticed by a book blogger with a huge following who wrote about it and shared it on social media. It obviously appealed to people because sales took off and haven't stopped since. I've been fortunate."
The other presenter picked up a copy of the book and leaned forward on the couch, a well-practiced look of sincerity on his craggy face.
"I read it at the weekend, and I have to say, I couldn't put it down. The way you've written your story, so simply, yet with such feeling, is quite incredible. I'm not surprised it's become such a success."
Hugh smiled.
"Well, I was lucky to be able to write it at all. In my old life, I was a computer programmer, you see. But I was able to give that up to write because my fiancé at the time was willing to support me."
"Oh, so you were a kept man," said Legs with a coquettish smile.
Hugh chuckled. "I suppose I was for a while. But if I hadn't been, I couldn't have written the book. It was because of my ex-fiancé's support that I was able to write it in the first place. She was willing to support me, and for that, I'll always owe her a huge debt of gratitude."
Claudia clicked her tongue and channeled a snort of disdain through her nostrils. "Gratitude. It's a bit late for that now, isn't it? He should have shown you a bit more gratitude when you were together."
"Mum, shh."
"I understand you've just come back from Tuscany, haven't you?"
said Legs.
Hugh nodded. "With my friend, Mario. He has a place there and we've spent quite a lot of time fixing it up over the past few months." "And am I right in assuming that Mario is the person you credit in the dedication in the book?" said Craggy Face. "That's right. He's been the most amazing friend to me. Our time in Tuscany has been a cathartic experience for us both. I split with my fiancé and he lost his wife the year before last. I consider him a special friend.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?